Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on Key Developments in Community Care by Andrew Sharland, QC. This talk was given at the 11KBW Community Care COP and Health Conference on the 14th of May 2019 at the Crown Plaza on New Bridge Street in London. For more information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk about key developments in community care law over the last year. When I was allocated this topic at the beginning of the year, I thought the majority of the talk would focus on the long-awaited Green Paper on Social Care, which was due to be published in April of this year. Perhaps such thoughts were a little naive, given four previous deadlines for the publication had been missed. It should have been out in the summer of 2017. In July 2017, the government said, we cannot wait any longer, we need to get on with this. Notwithstanding that, summer 18 deadline came and went, autumn 18 deadline came and went, and then the April 2019 deadline came and went. When we do finally see a paper, what will it contain? Well, during the various years that we've been promised this paper, the responsibility for social care has moved from the Cabinet Office back to the Department of Health. There's been a shift from one green paper promised, covering social care for all adults, to two green papers, one covering older adults and one covering working age adults, back to one. Last month, instead of a green paper, we had a House of Commons briefing paper talking about what it may contain. And what is promised is a comprehensive and thorough assessment of how social care is funded. When it is published, we are likely to see proposals introducing a cap on social care spending by individuals, a more generous means test. Of course, at present, someone requiring social care in a care home is only eligible for local authority funding towards the costs of such provision if they have capital assets below £23,000, and that may include the value of the home. The 2017 Conservative Manifesto, and obviously everything in there that's promised happens, the 2017 Manifesto said the value of the family home will be taken into account regardless of where the social care is provided. At present, it's taken into account when you're looking at the cost of residential care, but not social care outside that context. There was a proposal to set the means test floor at 100,000. So if you've got £100,000, that's disregarded, or that's the proposal. And thirdly, to permit payments to be deferred so that no one will have to sell their home in the lifetime to pay for care. Also proposed a cap on lifetime social care charges. The Care Act 2014, we all remember that quite a while ago, envisaged a cap. The coalition government stated that cap would be brought into force in April 2016 and set at £72,000. That was subsequently deferred to April 2020. No mention of the level of cap to be introduced then. It's been further put back. It said it's not going to happen in April 2020, but no new date has been provided, no indication of where the level of cap will be set when it is introduced. Other matters that the Green Paper is going to perhaps consider are care ISAs, exciting new financial product, and tax-free withdrawals from pension pots for care insurance. There's also likely to be a response to the Competition and Market Authority Care Home Report, which was published in November 2017, because of the great concern about the care home market and the number of care homes that are closing because the level of funding local authorities are providing is said not to be sufficient to meet the needs of people being accommodated there. A green paper has been promised as soon as possible and hopefully this summer, but I wouldn't hold your breath. In the remaining 25 minutes of the talk, I'm going to talk about three cases and a local government ombudsman's report. I think it's been relatively slim pickings over the last year. Only one of these, the three cases I'm going to talk about, the VI case, concerns the Care Act. And I think it's surprising how few judgments on the Care Act have been. Normally, when you have a significant new act, it generates a flurry of case law whilst the principles are worked out. But much to the disappointment of barristers who practice in this area, that flurry hasn't really occurred. First case I'm going to talk about is not a Care Act case at all. It's a Children Act case. It's a Supreme Court decision in Williams and Hackney, London Borough Council. Now, this case addressed the following three issues, amongst other things. Firstly, when a parent will be treated as having voluntarily delegated their parental responsibility to a local authority, pursuant to Section 20. Secondly, when a parent's request for the return of their children renders continuing Section 20 accommodation unlawful. And thirdly, the risk of keeping children in accommodation pursuant to Section 20 for a long time. Before we look at the facts, a bit of context. In March 2017, local authorities in England were looking after nearly 73,000 children, a figure that had been steadily increasing over the last 10 years. Just over 50,000 of those children were subject to care orders. 16,500 were accommodated without a court order, invariably pursuant to Section 20 of the Children Act, and the remaining 6,000 were accommodated pursuant to various other compulsory powers. In practice, the distinction between these categories is not always clear-cut, as demonstrated by the facts in Williams. However, in law, the distinction is clear. Compulsory intervention in the lives of children requires a court order. Providing them with services, including accommodation, does not. The legislation sets out a clear dividing line between those two categories of case. But the facts on the ground, sometimes it's a bit muddied. The Williams case concerned a family of eight children, ranging from ages between 14 years and 2 years, and 8 months. The 12-year-old boy was caught shoplifting food. He told the police he had nothing to eat and his father beat him with a belt. The police went to the family's home and it was found to be unhygienic and in a very dangerous state, unfit for habitation of children. The children were thus taken out of their home environment. The parents were interviewed and prohibited with having unsupervised contact. They then went to the local authority and were asked to sign a safeguarding agreement. Now, this safeguarding agreement provided that the children remain... Grab a seat, there's some papers there, no problem. The children remain in foster care for the present time. It said that the agreement was not to be legally binding, but that it may have significance in forthcoming proceedings. However, it didn't explain its potential relevance. Importantly, the parents were not informed of their right to object to children's continuing accommodation under Section 27 or their right to remove under Section 20, subsection 8. The agreement did not mention the legal basis under which the local authority were looking after the children. However, it was agreed, as the case wound its way through the courts, that for the first 72 hours, the children were being accommodated pursuant to Section 46 of the Children Act, which gives the police emergency powers to remove children, place them with the local authority for a period of up to 72 hours. And after that 72-hour period had expired, they were accommodated pursuant to Section 20. The matter was heard in July 2015. The court dismissed claims against the local authority for negligence, misfeasance in public office, and religious discrimination. However, they upheld a Human Rights Act claim. The parents said, our Article 8 rights, the right to respect for private and family life, have been breached, have been interfered with, and that interference was not in accordance with the law. And the High Court accepted that argument. The High Court said there was no lawful basis for accommodating the children after the 72-hour period had expired. because, and this is important, the parents had not given positive and informed consent to look after children, and this was a requirement to Section 20. And it's understandable why the High Court held that, because there were various judgments that said it was essential that for a child to be accommodated pursuant to Section 20, parents gave informed consent, they knew what they were consenting to, and they were aware of the Section 20 powers and their rights under Section 20. Now, Court of Appeal reversed the High Court. They concluded that the Section 20 accommodation was lawful. The parents were prevented from looking after their children because of bail conditions, and therefore issues of consent were not relevant. Now, the Supreme Court upheld the Court of Appeal's decision, but on different grounds. The Supreme Court, I'm going to set out the general principles that the Supreme Court expounded, because I think they're of general importance. This slide just touches on various cases that the Supreme Court discussed where human rights damages had been awarded for breach of Article 8 in this context. There have been a number of judgments where the courts have held local authorities haven't got the requisite informed consent and awarded damages between sort of £4,000 and £20,000. Now, Lady Hale, the President of the Supreme Court, expounded six important principles that I'm going to discuss in the next couple of slides. Firstly, parental responsibility encompasses all the rights of a parent, including the right to look after and bring up one's own children. The talk about consent or positive consent, which had been the focus at the High Court and to a lesser extent the Court of Appeal, was confusing. What is actually happening, Lady Hale held, is delegation by the parent to local authority of parental responsibility. If a parent doesn't agree to delegate parental responsibility for their children, if a parent does agree, that delegation must be real and voluntary. It must be a choice. It mustn't be the local authority saying, you must do this. However, and this is a contrast to the earlier decisions, there is no requirement that that delegation must be fully informed. There's no requirement that the local authority have to explain how Section 20 works, and particularly how Section 27, subsection 7 and subsection 8 work. There's no absolute requirement, although it is good practice for the local authority to inform parents of their rights under those two subsections, the right to withdraw consent and to take the child back. Third important principle is a distinction between a child removing a child from a family and stepping into the breach. If there's no parent actually looking after a child at the time, because, for example, they've been abandoned, no issue of delegation of parental responsibility arises because no one's actually exercising parental responsibility. The more difficult issue is in a case like this where you have parents who wish to exercise parental responsibility, but there are problems. Fourth point court made, parents may ask the local authority to accommodate a child as part of the services they provide that child in need. Importantly, local authority cannot accommodate a child pursuant to Section 20 if a parent is willing and able to accommodate them and objects to the local authority accommodating them. There is no power. And if the local authority accommodates in such circumstances, they have no power to do so. Therefore, any such provision is not in accordance with the law, and therefore you are looking at a human rights damages claim because it's clearly an interference with the right to family life, and it can't be justified, however proportionate it is, because it's not in accordance with the law. Secondly, a parent may remove a child from accommodation at any time. Accommodation pursuant to Section 20. No requirement to give notice, in writing or otherwise. Court went on to talk about the appropriateness of using Section 20 in the long term. Section 20 doesn't place any explicit limits on the length a child can be accommodated pursuant to Section 20, and there were examples of very lengthy Section 20 placements. But the court went on to suggest that that's not necessarily in the best interest of the child. If they're subject to a care order, there are various advantages to the child from such an order. And it may be depending on the particular facts, accommodating a child for a very lengthy period pursuant to Section 20 might be unlawful, both in the domestic sense, because it's irrational, and also contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights. But the guidance on that is quite vague. It's just something to bear in mind. On the facts of the particular case, there was no breach of Article 8, as the children were being looked after in accordance with the law. The parent solicitor had sent a letter saying, we want the children back, and it's our intention to get them back in the near future. But the court analysed that letter as not an unequivocal request for return. Solicitors seeking to sort out something in the future in a collaborative way. So no breach of Article 8 in this case, because the court held that the provision of accommodation was in accordance with the law. Second case we're going to look at is the case of V.I. Lewisham. This is a Care Act case, concerned a 55-year-old woman with muscular dystrophy. As I'm sure most of you are aware, this is an incurable disease, and it's degenerative. You don't get better, you just get worse. She was dependent on carers for all personal care, and the new assessment had confirmed a reduction of funding for her care package from 104 hours per week to 40 hours per week. So a very drastic cut. She lost over half the provision, and in particular, sleeping carer ceased. The Lewisham's decision was challenged on various grounds. It was firstly said it was irrational, as there's no improvement in her condition. It's only going to get worse, and therefore it's irrational to reduce provision. Claimant said that the council's suggestion that the previous care package had been very large over-provision had no basis in fact. Also said that it was inadequately reasoned. There were various breaches of the Care Act alleged, including a failure to have regard to the wellbeing factors set out in Section 1.2. It was said that there was a failure to assess against eligibility outcomes set out in the regulations, and a failure to cooperate with NHS services, particularly OT and physio. This claim failed on all grounds. I think this is a very local authority-friendly judgment. It's a very light-touch judgment, and I would contrast it with the Ombudsman's case that I'm going to deal with at the end, where the Ombudsman was far more willing to look at the substance. In this case, the court concluded it wasn't irrational to cut the level of provision in half, notwithstanding the level of need had not changed. The court placed quite a lot of emphasis on a trial removal of night care following consultation with nurses, which had not led to any major issues, which the court said supported the council's assessment. It was also said no breach of the Care Act, and on the facts, the council did adequately assess against the eligibility outcomes. The court said it's not our job to engage in a detailed textual analysis of the assessment, so very, very deferential to the local authority. Court also said there had been no failure to cooperate with other services. Section 3.1 of the Care Act provides a general duty to exercise functions with a view to ensuring integration of care and support with health provision, but that did not impose an absolute requirement to have a health input into an assessment, and what was done by the local authority was held to be sufficient, albeit it was very limited. So I think this is an example of the courts appreciating the pressures local authorities are under, the massive difficulties with budgets, and a lack of willingness to intervene in what was a pretty stark case. Final case I'm going to talk about is the Royal Mencap Society case. Completely different, albeit local authority finances clearly very relevant in this context as well. This is an employment case. In April 2017, the Employment Appeal Tribunal handed down judgment. They held that the minimum wage did apply for all the time sleeping carers required to be on particular premises, whether it's a care home or an individual's home. It was held that they were working during that time and therefore were entitled to the minimum wage per hour. Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs issued guidance and commenced a scheme to ensure the payment of back pay, because lots of people hadn't been paid at that rate. They'd been paid a flat rate, £30-40 per night. The workers contractually obliged to spend time at the place, but they're expected to sleep most of that time, but can be woken up if required. Now, the Court of Appeal reversed the findings of the EAT. Lord Justice Underhill held that sleepers in are to be characterised for the purpose of the regulations as available for work rather than actually working, and therefore fall within the terms of the sleep-in exception. So they don't get a minimum wage, that they can be paid £30 or £40 a night. The Supreme Court have recently granted permission to appeal in this case, because there is now a conflict of authority at the Court of Appeal level. You have the Royal Mencap Society that applied the sleepers in exception. They read Regulation 30 and 32 of the National Minimum Wages regulations together. And that approach can be contrasted with a couple of earlier decisions from the Court of Appeal, British Nursing Association and the Inland Revenue, and the Scotbridge construction case, which concerned a night watchman rather than a carer, where different approaches were adopted. In the Scotbridge case and the British Nursing Association case, rather than considering Regulation 30 and 32 together, the court looked at Regulation 30 and considered what was actually happening, whether a person who was sleeping in was actually working, notwithstanding they were sleeping, and they concluded that they were. So the Supreme Court hearing is scheduled for February 2020. I was talking to counsel for the appellant yesterday, and it was actually scheduled for October this year. They were very much hoping for Lady Hale, but it's now been delayed to next year after Lady Hale has retired, so they are less optimistic, it's fair to say. But we will see. I think it's obviously an important case because of the financial ramifications for local authorities and care home providers. It's also obviously a very important case for people who work in care homes, who are one of the poorest paid sectors in the country, pay-wise. Final topic, local government ombudsman report in relation to Wiltshire. And as I flagged up when I was talking about the VI case, I think you can contrast the approach of the ombudsman in this case with the court in the VI case. And the local government ombudsman provides far more in-depth scrutiny, far more analysis of the actual substance of the decision. And I think there is perhaps a trend for claimant, and maybe this explains why there haven't been that many Care Act challenges. I think as a result of funding pressures on legal aid, it's far harder to get legal aid to bring challenges. Claimants, individuals who feel they've been unfairly treated, unlawfully treated, are more often going to the Ombudsman rather than the High Court, and they're regularly getting success in front of the Ombudsman, which perhaps is encouraging that route. I know from a number of local authority clients I have, local authorities are concerned with local government ombudsman decision making, and some of them are looking to challenge such decisions by judicial review when the right case comes along. I think the ombudsman, like every public authority, almost every public authority, is under significant financial pressure, and I've been told that the level of investigation, the speed of investigation, is not what it once was. So one area we may see more challenges is challenges to the local government and social care ombudsman's decisions because of the impact they're having on social care funding. But back to the Wiltshire case, this concerned a disabled adult with very complex needs. He had severe learning difficulties and epilepsy. Like the VI case, significant cut to provision, cut to respite provision and transport to weekday care placements. The Ombudsman found that the cut was unlawful. The council's policies that had been applied, the matrix assessment model, were found to breach the Care Act because they didn't focus on the eligible needs of the individual. Instead, they said, we have X amount of resources and we need to allocate that. We banned people, and if you're a particular band, you get X resources. If you're in a lower band, you get less than that. But the level of resources were driven by the rationing and the total amount of resources available rather than the individual's particular eligible needs. And the Ombudsman said that's the wrong approach. Care Act provides that eligible needs must be met regardless of the cost, and therefore you, Wiltshire, have acted unlawfully. You have to pay compensation and make greater provision in the future. And decisions like this, I think, are likely to encourage claimants to go the Ombudsman route in the future. My time has finished, so thank you very much for listening. Next up is Jonathan.